The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everyone, this is Duncan Crary. You're listening to The Kuntzercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kuntzler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. Some of you might be interested to know that I've been doing a lot of interviews lately, some of them audio, to promote the Kuntzercast book and talk about my role on the show over these past 4 years. So if you would like to read or listen to those, visit kuntzercast.com/book. And don't forget, there's still time to order a copy for yourself or for a friend before the holidays. On today's show, I'm going to talk with Jim about sports and fake warrior culture. Jim, okay, we're in your new office setup here, in your new digs.
My new cave, which is actually not too different from the last one in the rent-a-condo, in the sense that it's in the basement. It has a walkout to the rear, but this time we have a view of the hills of eastern New York going towards the Green Mountains of Vermont, and deer that are coming out in the lawn, and all kinds of wonders of nature.
Now, listeners, I decided to just record with Jim on the handheld for this session because you're still moving in, Jim, and we haven't really figured out where we should set up the equipment. So, folks, it sounds a little bit different, but some people like the way this microphone sounds. And I want to apologize. My voice has been a little gravelly the past few podcasts. I have been doing some reveling out and about in town.
Have you been drinking radioactive cocktails with depleted uranium or the old casings of nuclear reactors or something?
Yeah, a little bit of that. It's also the holiday season, you know, around here, a lot of the small cities, they don't have too many people my age, you know, young people, young professionals. You know, we have college students, but we don't have people my age, and they all come back for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I'm amazed every time I go to the Spectrum Theater in Albany, which is like the sole surviving art theater cineplex. And, you know, Albany is basically a one-company town because it's the capital of New York State, and we have tons and tons and tons of civil servants. And just about everybody there is a civil servant on the verge of retirement. They're all like old gray-haired, white-haired people, and it's always so sort of startling.
Yes, so when all the young people came back, I went a little wild because I only get once a year to really do it, and I was just catching up with people my age.
When you go out drinking, do you mostly hit on like 80-year-old women?
Yeah, I stick to the 80-year-olds, Jim.
That's mostly what we have around here.
A lot of my friends, though, are in their 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, honestly, just from out and about. Mm-hmm. I mean, the booze keeps them young at heart, at least.
Well, you get to a certain point where it doesn't keep you so young in any dimension, actually. It actually ages you more quickly.
All right. So we actually do have a more serious topic for today's show. We've got some listener calls, three of them, and they're all related to professional sports in America. And we are in the football season, and we're getting ramped up to the greatest spectacle of the year in America, the Super Bowl. So I thought these would be timely. And you've written a little bit about sports on your blog. So, Jim, why don't we play the first listener call to set it up, and then we'll hear back from you.
Hey, James. Hey, Duncan. This is Ryan. I'm calling from Philadelphia. I just wanted to get your input on what you thought about the field of sports once everything starts going down the proverbial tubes and can't really afford to pay athletes huge sums of money or have fancy training centers and be able to fly them all over the world. Don't really have the resources to do that anymore, not to mention building stadiums. What do you think is going to happen? Will we have seen the end of what the human can achieve? Thanks, and have a great day.
Okay, so Jim, what do you think the future of professional sports are going to be like in America and elsewhere as we head into this new energy future and also financial future?
Yeah, and I think you mean the energy scarce future. And I actually did think about this a bit when I was writing The Long Emergency. And it seems perfectly obvious that the normal American sports paradigm of today can't possibly persist very far into the future. For one thing, I don't really see that the teams are going to even be able to travel around to the extent that they do now, where, you know, literally you have the whole New York Yankees getting on a charter flight, you know, every 3 days and going from one city to another all across the continent. One of the events that happened this week was the bankruptcy of American Airlines. And I have a feeling that the commercial aviation industry is going to get into a lot of trouble, and that's going to affect professional sports as it's now practiced. There are a couple of other elements to the story. One is that the American middle class is obviously becoming kind of impoverished, or at least their standard of living is being driven way down. And at the same time, we're in this weird situation where sporting events, which were once kind of proletarian entertainments that were fairly cheap, have now become incredibly expensive. And I mean, I actually remember when I was a young newspaper writer in the early 70s in Boston, I went to Fenway Park all the time, and I was broke, but you could get a decent seat for $5, a box seat, you know? Now you can't get a decent seat in Fenway Park for under $100, and I'm sure that it's similar for pro football and basketball. So, you know, that whole angle of the story is changing.
Jim, how about the gigantic scale at which professional sports are occurring at this point in history? How do you even feel about sports being so large and blown up, these huge stadiums, the expensive tickets, all the salaries? I would imagine you're not too keen on any of that.
Well, for one thing, the scale of sports is like all these other activities that have evolved in American life and have you know, expanded and swollen up to a gigantic scale that can't possibly be sustained, whether it's sports or big box retailing or the tourist industry or, you know, cable television or, you know, any number of other things that have just gotten so elaborate and complex and giant, and they can't possibly continue at that scale.
It's not a very intimate experience either, just being a fan anymore with sports occurring at such a gigantic scale.
I'm not sure that it has been intimate in that sense for a long, long time. After all, Yankee Stadium, which was built in about 1925 or so, you know, that was a huge ballpark. It held about 67,000 people. So those kinds of mass entertainments, you know, along with Nuremberg rallies, which were, you know, another kind of political sporting event, you know, those were all done on a pretty giant scale. It's been a long time. You know, it was back really probably at the turn of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, when you go from having fairly regionalized teams in fairly small venues, you know, like the ballpark that the New York Highlanders played in 1900, you know, or around that time. And the early ballparks were much smaller. And, of course, they weren't traveling these vast distances. And when they were traveling, they were mostly going on trains. Major League Baseball really didn't happen west of the Mississippi River until after World War II. Until quite a bit after World War II. And, you know, that's when the Dodgers moved from Brooklyn to Los Angeles, et cetera, et cetera. But before then, like, you know, St. Louis or maybe Kansas City was about as far west as any pro team would go. And,
yeah, because, you know, I am a creature of the pubs, I admit it. So, I watch sports when they're on the TV out at the pubs, but I don't follow sports. And I don't really give a shit. The closest professional teams from here are 150 miles away. You got to pick either, you know, New York or Boston for baseball, or New York or Buffalo for football, et cetera. So I don't really give a shit about these teams that are from so far away. I really feel like we're getting robbed of having our own local or regional teams.
Yeah, I agree. I was a baseball fan myself until probably my mid-30s, and you know, I don't give a shit anymore either. But I have this fantasy about maybe the role of sports in this long emergency future, which is that it is the one thing that you can do at a much smaller scale and still get a lot of pleasure out of it. You know, you can have regional baseball leagues, you can have local baseball leagues or football leagues or, you know, any other kind of sport. And although I also do imagine that people are going to be a lot busier with physical labor 10, 20 years from now than they have been. And there's going to be a lot less of what we would consider to be contemporary leisure. But I could see sports actually on the local level coming in and taking the place of a lot of canned entertainment that people now, you know, that's standard fare for filling up their leisure time or whatever leisure time they have in the future.
Yeah, and you can channel some of your, I don't know, animosities or extra energy towards more healthy rivalries like the hockey teams, you know?
Or not only that, I mean, you could even participate in it. I mean, you can have a lot more people actually playing the games rather than just sitting in the stands, you know, if you have a lot of different layers of local leagues and things. So that would be kind of exciting.
Okay, so Jim, we got another question about the infrastructure of sports. So I think we're going in the right direction. So let's play that listener question and hear what he has to say.
Hello, Duncan and Jim. This is Christian calling from Texas, near outside of Houston. I'm your goat farmer buddy. Anyway, I just finished listening to the cast on The Preservationist, and it made me think of something that's going on around here right now. The Astrodome in Houston has lived well beyond its useful life, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. And a good architect buddy of mine is insistent that we need to save it. I personally have worked in that building when I was in the entertainment industry, and it's pretty horrifying on the inside and really doesn't look like it's suitable for any sort of retrofit that would be productive or lovable in any way other than kitsch. And that's just what I was thinking about during the Preservationist episode, which was fantastic. Good work to both of you, by the way, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the Astrodome. Thanks so much.
So what to do with the Astrodome, Jim?
A grain elevator. Does anyone remember that wonderful movie from 1971 directed by Robert Altman called Brewster McCloud? It's such an obscure movie now that you can barely even get it in the rentals. But it took place in the Astrodome, and it was about a sort of lost, spiritually wayward young man who is taken up by an angel, played by Sally Kellerman, and builds himself a flying machine, you know, builds himself these mechanical wings so he can soar about the Astrodome. I recommend it for anyone who loves Robert Altman's movies, and I'm one of his great fans. Anyway, what will happen to these things? Well, God, who knows? But I have said before, and I still maintain that the salvage business is going to be enormous in the decades ahead, because we're going to have such a scarcity of metals and fabricated materials. And, you know, it's conceivable to me that places like this will be, you know, sort of strip mined for their materials. Otherwise, you know, I don't really see them being used for, you know, Roman-style Colosseum, you know, Mad Max gladiatorial combats, or, you know, rounding up whatever wild animals or red wolves or Tasmanian tigers they can find, setting them loose upon, you know, meth freaks or some kind of an entertainment like that. I actually think we're just simply going to go in there and grab the materials. And there's a lot of stuff in there. You know, there's a lot of steel, a lot of aluminum, a lot of concrete block, and all that stuff's going to have value, and a lot of copper pipes, and we're going to be hard up for all that stuff.
So, Jim, what should our listener say to his architect buddy who's trying to preserve the Astrodome? What are the arguments against preserving the thing?
Well, first, let's give the argument for the positive argument for saving some of these things, and it seems fairly obvious that, you know, these are kind of wondrous megastructures. I mean, the whole preservation industry is engaged in a very tricky kind of critical enterprise now about having to decide which fucked up 20th century buildings they're going to put their energy into saving. because there's so much of this stuff, as you know, as I wrote in Geography of Nowhere, and this was 20 years ago, 80% of everything ever built has been built in the, you know, the last, in the post-war period, and now we're 20 years past that, so we have this immense amount of stuff. And it's probably going to amount to a triage process where you, you know, a formal process where you really decide that, you know, A, B, D, L, and X are worth saving, but we're not so sure about E, Q, R, and T. You know, if you alphabetize all of the projects. So, you know, some of these things might just kind of stand out of neglect and a lack of capital to do anything about them, you know, and until they get to the point where they will be salvaged. But I can understand why people would want to save an awesome structure, but I'm not sure what they're going to save it for to use as in terms of being a useful structure. And to just save it as an object to behold from the street, or to wander inside and behold, as long as it's structurally safe to do it, you know, that seems a little weird. I don't know. You know, there may be people who would say, "Oh, these are, you know, this is the Roman Colosseum of our time," but it's not really built as well as a Roman Colosseum, and you know, it's probably going to be one of those things that, you know, falls apart.
So, Jim, switching gears totally, but still on topic of sports, you blogged recently about the Penn State scandal in which an assistant football coach raped a young boy and I think had a few other victims, and there was a cover-up for many years.
Quite a few other victims. I'm more, you know, more than a baker's half dozen.
And this really kind of pissed you off about American culture in general. So can you tell me why this particular incident? Because you hear about horrible things in the news all the time. Why did this one really set you off?
Well, you know, the sexual part of it was only kind of the cherry on top of a general picture of depravity that surrounds organized sports, both professional and, you know, semi-professional or collegiate or whatever. We're not even sure what that is. And that's probably the big problem with it, is that it pretends to be an amateur sport, but in fact, it's an enormous money-making enterprise, both for the school and for individuals. You know, it sets the fortunate young men who actually get into who are selected to play, and the even smaller percentage of elite college players who are selected to play in the pro level. You know, they're basically looking at just monumental amounts of a lifetime of income in 6 years or something, you know. Although it has a lot of drawbacks, like absolutely horrendous, debilitating injuries and you know, terrible chronic illnesses that come from this playing this football. But there's also the sort of disgraceful thing of the coaches at all these big football schools getting paid $1 million salaries, you know, when the adjunct academic professors can't even get health insurance. So the whole collegiate sports picture is just disgusting and awful, and kind of represents everything that is unreflectively accepted in our culture as being okay, when in fact it's very unokay. And then there's the whole professional level, which from a money-grubbing standpoint, if anything, is even more disgusting than the college. But, you know, I'm quite sure that it's not going to persist. We get back to that old kind of formula that when an organism, or in this case an institution, reaches its evolutionary dead end, what happens often in the ending process is that it assumes its greatest scale at or near the very end, you know, like the fabled Baluchitherium giant grazing mammal of the Asian steppes, you know, which was a giant rhinoceros-like creature that was about the size of an RV. And, you know, these creatures evolved and got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And when they were at their biggest climactic size, you know, that was when their die-off occurred. And I think we're going to see the same thing with the scale and practice of professional sports.
Right. Okay, so the what I want to talk about now is the warrior culture in America, and particularly fake warrior culture. It's something that bothers you about tattoos, but it also bothers you about professional sports.
Yeah, and you know, it's getting there's getting to be kind of a merging between sports warrior culture and like machine warrior culture with like the motorcycle dogs and you know that's all kind of merging into a Mad Max kind of meth freak wild man high testosterone persona that's become the popular way of being a man in America for a certain class of people and a very large class of people, you know, mostly, you know, the sort of the lower middle class and yonder. And what strikes me about it is that it's becoming harder and harder to find a way to be a man in America that is, you know, kind of a dignified way of being, not to mention a way of being in terms of a vocation or a trade or a what used to be called a job, you know, to be gainful in a way that gives you a sense of you know, being able to take care of yourself and your family. So there are all these sort of male identity problems in America that are just becoming huge. And they have all to do fundamentally with the potency and capacity of men to be able to accomplish things and feel like men and feel like adults. And so, you know, people, a lot of young males are taking refuge in being babies, one way or another, either dressing like babies or acting like babies, especially emotionally acting like babies. And, you know, on the other hand, you have a range of people who are acting out these weird hyper male roles of, you know, either pumping iron so that they look like they're inflated Macy's Thanksgiving Day balloon dolls, you know, or guys who are affecting all of this sort of, you know, machine motorcycle drag mixed with pirate gear and you know other kind of costuming flourishes, then you have sort of the video game realm of people affecting to be warriors by sitting on a sofa and punching a little console and you know shedding a lot of blood on a screen. And these are all mainly artificial ways of being a man. And we do not have a coherent, dignified male identity in America anymore. And I think what's going to happen is that we'll go down a certain distance on these various pathways with this fake warrior culture. And eventually, we'll see a flip-flop, you know, where real men in America will come along and kind of put an end to this kind of behavior. And it could be a kind of a nasty, gnarly, authoritarian event in American history. But there's another side to all the fake warrior culture stuff, which is the suspicion that behind it lurk a lot of cowards and pussies and people who feel inadequate and people who, you know, are really the opposite of what they're pretending to be, you know, sort of craven, cowardly guys who have a very poor self-image of themselves and are not confident about their identity. And, you know, it's hard to say how we're going to get there.
Okay, Jim, well, I got a great final listener call to take the show out with.
Duncan and Jim, this is Farmer Troy calling from Northwest Pennsylvania. I'm a little bit late in getting to the recent podcast, but I finally got around to listening to the Occupy one. And one of your comments was that there were a lot of warriors out there who didn't have anything to do. And I was wondering if you ever heard of the Farmer Veteran Coalition, which is one of several groups that are putting veterans on farms to become farmers. It looks like a pretty good program, and I'm actually a veteran myself, not from the current war, I'm actually a little bit older than that. But when I got out of the Army, I became a farmer, and I've been doing it for almost 19 years now. So hopefully we can turn our swords into plowshares and put these farmers, these warriors, and turn them into farmers. Thank you very much.
I always enjoy hearing from Farmer Troy. Called in before. Jim, have you heard from have you heard of the Farmer Veteran Coalition?
Actually, no. It's entirely new to me.
Well, it sounds like an interesting program. You had mentioned previously you were talking about we were talking about Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Everything, and you were sort of wondering what a lot of our real warriors, as in veterans of wars, are going to do when they come back to America, and if they can't find work, it could be a troublesome situation. And this Farmer Veteran Coalition sounds like an interesting idea. It's farming is a physical job, right? You come back all. You're pretty tough after being in the Army. You need to keep your muscles working, and you know, in order to keep that up. So farming seems like a good idea. What do you think?
Well, I think in one major way, it's definitely more wholesome than some of the other things that people do, even physically, that men do even physically in America. You know, a lot of the whole business of working around machines has to do either with two things, with either making things go really fast, in a dangerous way, you know, which ends up in a kind of a NASCAR mentality, or working with machines that make people dead or, you know, hurt them, which is the military side of it. And we need a physical realm for men to be men that is not about speed and death. And agriculture is something, I think, in the way that it will be more likely to be practiced in the future, which is to say, probably closer to what we now consider to be organic farming, but a form of farming that involves far less in the way of technological interventions, far less machinery, far less technology, and much more intimate knowledge of how nature actually works, and intimate contact with the workings of nature on a, you know, a moment by moment basis, out there, you know, during the day, being in the world in a real sort of way, and working in a way that is not just about things that are not good for us, namely speed and death.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks a lot for talking to us. I know you've been pretty busy, and I enjoyed checking out your new digs, and I'll be back.
Thank you, actually, for making the trek up here for the first time. You know, we go back and forth between your crib and my crib, and you know, I may not ask you to make this journey as much as you were making it in the past to Saratoga. I may be coming down to your crib a little bit more, but we'll be here, and the whole process of moving is absolutely exhausting. I've done it more than a couple of times in the last 3 years, as I went through the tail end of my experience as a renter, which was a 7-year ordeal. It's not the worst way of being in the world, but at my age, I needed a place where I could really settle in. And so I spent about 3 weeks humping stuff around and moving and constructing shelves and, you know, outfitting this place for livability in the style that I'm used to. And I'm pretty exhausted, and I really am very grateful that you came up here for the day and we were able to do this.
Yeah, it was a great drive. Now, Jim, you might be able to enlist some veterans to help you get your garden up and running.
Actually, I do have a scheme. I need some deer fencing pretty badly, because this little corner of New York State is absolutely infested with deer. And there, speaking of sports, it is a fact that there are fewer and fewer hunters around. And you yourself grew up in a culture of hunting, but I think it was more like the aristocratic sporting game bird.
We didn't have English pet
stream, you know, upland bird, tweed jacketed kind of sport.
Yes, but unlike the Brits, we didn't have young peasant boys beating the bushes for us.
Or Bengali peasants, you know, beating the jungle for a tiger. But This is a more of a rough and ready corner of the country, and the kind of hunting around here is more like, you know, you go out there with a bottle of Jack Daniels and sit in a tree for 6 hours and wait for a deer to find you and ask to be slaughtered. But the fact is there are fewer and fewer hunters, and the deer population is just out of this world up here. In fact, probably past the point where it's even healthy for the deer. You know, I read something this week that we're going through another one of those years of an acorn drought where the oak trees just did not produce many acorns. And we don't know whether it's connected to global warming, climate change, or whether it's some other kind of a cyclical phenomenon, or whether it's perhaps a plant disease issue or some plant stress issue or what. But a lot of the animals that depend on that are going to go hungry this year, including probably a lot of deer. And so it's a kind of a sad situation, but right now we got a lot of deer, got to put up some deer fencing. And there's a religious cult about 10 miles up the road full of earnest young guys, dudes who I understand can be hired out to do this kind of physical labor. So I'm going to see if I can engage a couple of them to come over here and get her done.
Are these the guys? They all have blonde hair and blue eyes. They're like the village of the damned.
No. This is a cult about 12 miles away in the next village. And it's sort of I was a student of religious cults, and I'm generally not terribly in favor of them. But this one is a pretty wholesome one, it's going to be interesting to see to meet some of their dudes. I had a conversation with them about maybe coming over and helping me put this fence up because it's difficult physical labor. The reason that the deer fencing is necessary, it's not like I am allergic to them, is because I'm quite serious about doing some really extensive gardening around here and having an orchard on this piece of property that I was lucky enough to get. And the deer would just destroy the plantings. They'd make it impossible. So I really have to get serious about the deer fencing.
All right, Jim, we got cults and wild animals and rolling landscapes. This is truly living in a world made by hand up here. So thanks a lot. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye, Duncan.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.